I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Does not feel like October. Hasn't been feeling like October, has it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, last night I was at Cape Cod Bird Club and walked out, and it was just, it felt like it was 80 degrees and 110% humidity. I was like, what is it, monsoon season in the tropics? I said, what month is it?
Oh, it's crazy.
But this just seems to be the new norm, kind of periods like this. But yeah, you get some days of southwest winds, and we think about interesting birds being blown in. Haven't seen anything yet in terms of some of the species we expect when you get southwest winds, but we should be on the lookout for weird things like ash-throated flycatchers and even vermilion flycatchers. One just turned up somewhere, Michigan, I think. But birds from the desert southwest sometimes turn up in the northeast when you get these kind of warm bubbles of air, these southwest winds in the fall like this. But it feels strange.
Does it confuse? I mean, I know the migration really started quite a while ago, but there's still birds migrating. Does this confuse them?
I don't think so. There are some smaller birds that can get caught up in strong southwesterly flows and get blown back. I think it happens to cuckoos sometimes. I mean, cuckoos are on their way to South America, Central and South America. And sometimes in October, you'll get some winds, some southwest winds like this, and then all of a sudden there's cuckoos again. Mm-hmm. I think some hummingbirds will get blown back sometimes. But for the most part, they don't get confused by warm spells or, you know, they're just really their hormones right now are telling them to migrate, and they're looking for favorable winds. And migration is happening regardless. You know, I just stepped out of the car in our little parking lot here in Woods Hole 20 minutes ago because I was early for once. Everybody shocked everybody in the studio.
But Mark's here already.
They didn't know what to think. But I actually had time to do some birding in the parking lot. I looked up, and there were like 30 blue jays.
Wow, 30.
Flocking together. They were swirling over the harbor with probably about 20 robins. And these are two species where they make migration pretty obvious in September and October. Typically, they'll come in with cold fronts, but we haven't had real strong cold fronts. But westerly, any kind of westerly component to the wind can bring them here to the Cape. But both robins and blue jays, they're big and they migrate in flocks during the day. So they're a very obvious sign of bird migration. And these were birds that looked like they had just arrived. They were high and then they dropped down into some trees. And then they'll start kind of making their way inland and trying to figure out what their next step is. With the blue jays, we're pretty sure they're just assessing whether or not there are enough acorns. And if there aren't, they move on. We had a winter with there was just no mast production, meaning the oaks didn't produce any acorns a few years ago. And as a result, there were no blue jays that winter. But this year, there seem to be tons of acorns.
So we'll see
blue jays. So some of these blue jays that are coming in from the north will probably stay here. Some of ours probably are not going anywhere. So it looks like it's going to be a big, big winter for blue jays. And robins, they just do their thing. If you pay attention, you'll notice that they sort of disappear at the end of the summer. You're just not seeing robins. You're not hearing robins. And then you'll get some cold fronts, some westerly winds, and all of a sudden there's these big flocks of robins coming in. And those are coming from further north. Those mm-hmm. are our migrant robins that either keep going or maybe, you know, some portion of those will stay here for the winter.
Right.
Some cases, tens of thousands of them will winter on the Cape.
And our robins that are here in the summer, they're gone. They went south, right?
Right. So ours just kind of slip away, and, you know, maybe they're going to their timeshare and Cape Hatteras or whatever. You know, they're short-distance migrants.
Okay.
So, you know, you look at the birds that are around us in the summer. We have birds that don't migrate at all, you know, or chickadees and mice, nuthatches, woodpeckers. I shouldn't say not at all, but they generally are resident. And then you have short-distance migrants like robins and bluebirds. They might go, you know, several states away southwards. And then you have the long-distance migrants, things that we'll talk about some of them later that really just get out of town.
Yeah, and they're mind-boggling.
Go to South America.
Yeah.
If some shorebirds, I might go to the other end of South America.
That's
so there's
wild.
Some, and you know, falcons, things, there are things that are really going long distances in some cases.
Right. So when you've got these storms like we've had in winds, you never know what's going to blow in. So if somebody's got something interesting that they're seeing at their bird feeders, let us know. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So pretty surprised. People pretty surprised to see that mask booby come in, right? I mean, we didn't think there was much of anything. And then, whoop, here it is.
Yeah. That was just out of left field for a variety of reasons. So we could just kind of do a recap of Hurricane Jose in general to start. I was all excited, like a lot of birders. You get excited when a hurricane is approaching from the south. You have dreams of tropic birds and sooty terns and things dancing in your heads as you go to sleep before a hurricane is coming. Of course, you never know what these hurricanes will do. The best ones in terms of bringing good birds are the ones that come straight from the Caribbean, come up the coast, and then come inland. And those will fill up the coastal places sometimes with interesting birds that we would never see here otherwise. They're Caribbean, Gulf Stream, warm water, Caribbean-type species. And sometimes they'll get pushed all the way into, like, Berkshire County, upstate New York. We'll get birds that you would normally only see in Bermuda. I mean, it really switches things up, kind of makes things interesting for inland birders, but coastal birders as well. So Jose didn't do that. Jose just sort of parked itself offshore, I don't know, 120 miles off of Nantucket or something like that. And just like a bad party guest, he didn't leave.
Hung around.
Oh my God. It was the never ending nor'easter, the never ender. And just days of gale force, kind of northeast winds. And I'm going around storm birding to the, dutifully going to the places you're supposed to go during northeast winds, which is kind of north-facing bayside beaches. And I know other birders were going to Sandy Neck, which is what you're supposed to be doing, Sandy Neck and Barnstable. I was checking beaches in Brewster and going to First Encounter in Eastham. And, I was seeing things like lots of Cory shearwaters, which was very cool. I mean, obviously the storm loaded up Cape Cod Bay with Cory shearwaters, which you are not always easy to see from land. So that was cool. There were some Jaegers. But really, it wasn't what we were expecting. In terms of a storm that was bringing good storm birds, it was a dud. Right. And so it was here for several days, didn't produce much, a few Fowler ropes here and there. And then 2 days later, I get this text message. We think we have a brown booby. And it was a bird that was picked up at LeCount's Hollow in Wellfleet. It was called in as a gannet, which is pretty typical to find gannets that are sort of incapacitated sitting on a beach, those big giant diving birds with the big dagger bill, if people are familiar with gannets. But this was much smaller, and so they were thinking it was a brown booby, which was a logical conclusion. Super rare, but still, there's been a brown booby about every year off of the Outer Cape for the last 6 or 7 years. For some reason, something's going on with this tropical seabird that they're ending up in the Northeast more often. But I'm looking at the pictures, I'm like, geez, I think this is something even way more wackier than a brown booby. This is a masked booby. And this is a bird that had only ever been seen once before in technically Massachusetts waters, these waters out of the continental shelf, 100 miles south of Nantucket, way out there. I mean, this is like at the same latitude as New Jersey, but it's still, quote, Massachusetts waters. So we got to count it. One was photographed out there a couple of years ago. But this is the first masked booby ever to turn up on land or really within sight of land in Massachusetts.
In New England, right?
In New England, yeah. Really, it's broader than that. And that's weird for a few reasons. First of all, no other tropical birds seemingly came up with Hurricane Jose. Not that we found, anyway. I think there was a brown pelican up in Boston that turned up sometime after the storm. Probably was related, but this guy just seemed to be the only one. And in all the hurricanes from past years that have brought all manner of tropical birds, sooty terns, rare petrels from this, all kinds of crazy things, there'd never been a masked booby brought north by a hurricane to New England before. So it wasn't on anybody's radar, wasn't expected. We weren't like, maybe we'll get a masked booby.
Right.
So, you know, I think this guy was just out there alone. It was a young bird. And so young birds, we know for a lot of species, tend to wander and go places where the adults don't necessarily go. They'll go further north than mm-hmm. adults will go.
Push that, it, yeah.
That's true of bald eagles, ospreys, and seabirds as well. And so it just probably got trapped in the eye of the hurricane, which happens to birds. It's calm in the eye. And, you know, they end up trapped in the eye and just sort of moving north with the storm. And then I think it eventually got spit out by the storm, and those strong northeast winds brought it into shore in Wellfleet. But why this didn't happen to any other birds is sort of puzzling. But
wasn't in good shape. This poor bird was, as you said, sitting on the beach and not in the best shape from the storm.
Yeah, I mean, it was clearly sick, and I saw it that night at Wildcare. So it ended up in it where it should have ended up, which is Wildcare. And those guys are really good at what they do, and they immediately started contacting experts in care of tropical birds like that, people who have treated masked boobies at mm-hmm. other facilities in the South and around the country. You know, they did some cultures, and it had some respiratory infections that ultimately proved too much for it, and it did die. It's too bad. It seemed really spunky the night I saw it. He was kind of stabbing his bill at the poor woman who was trying to, you know, feed it some fluids. Young birds are good at one thing, and that's dying. Mm-hmm. Young birds have a hard life, and they often don't make it. And so this bird was a juvenile, and it was battered by this storm, and the prognosis was never good. But you know, Tufts University, the veterinary school there, will do a necropsy if they haven't already. I'm interested mm-hmm. in the results of that. I'm sure it'll just, you know, it was starved and, you know, had this infection.
Yeah.
It will probably be the result. And then the specimen will go to the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, their amazing collection they have there, and, you know, just will be available for researchers yeah. and whatever. So it's not like it just died out in the ocean like most young birds do
right.
and we never know about it. You know, this one's actually going to, you know, contribute to science to some extent.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point, Bird News with Mark Verity, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So the sea ducks and loons, their migration full swing right now. This is interesting because there are some birds who start their migration, it seems like, in August. Mm-hmm. And then we have like the sea ducks and the loons who are kind of hot right now.
Yeah, it's like I like to say, there's not a month of the year where something isn't migrating, where some bird isn't on the move, migrating. So yeah, there are like some warblers, things like yellow warblers, northern water thrushes. They're migrating in late July. Shorebirds are arriving early July from the Arctic. So a lot of things moving south already in midsummer. Really, summer just kind of getting started for some of us, and some of the birds are like, they're calling it.
Yeah,
you know,
done.
It's
done.
Fall. I'm heading south. You know, obviously that continues, and it's just at different times, there's different things are migrating. So right now, it's things like robins and blue jays, like we talked about. Waterfowl are really starting. Sparrows are big migrants in October. Some of the last warblers. But you're talking about the sea ducks and the loons. That's something people can see that can be very obvious at certain beaches. I was at First Encounter Beach in Eastham a couple different times in the last week, and there were just clouds of scoters migrating. And that's something you can see in Cape Cod Bay. Manomet Point in Plymouth, another good place to see scoter migration. You know, you might see thousands of them. Three species. There's white-winged scoter, surf scoter, and black scoter. And they're all big black sea ducks with kind of different patterns of either white or orange on them. And they're coming from, you know, Arctic and subarctic nesting areas and moving into our area. They'll be here all winter. Some are moving through and continuing south, but then there'll be thousands that spend the winter here. if you look at the oceans have more birds on them here on the Cape in the winter than they do in the summer.
That's interesting.
Yeah, when you add up all of these, I mean, there might be 500,000 common eiders, and common eiders are also these big sea ducks. They're starting to move into the area. But it might be 500,000 common eiders just off of Monomoy in the winter, and then hundreds of thousands of scoters of three species, and all the loons. You know, there's thousands of red-throated loons that come through. A lot of common loons winter here. So, you know, the gannets are around. So there can be a huge biomass of birds here in the winter, just kind of blanketing the ocean, sections of ocean that would be pretty blank in the summer. So it's just kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah. Let's talk to Peter, who's giving us a call from Bass River. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Yesterday we had about 13 wild turkeys moving through our yard and pecking around, and they spent a good half hour here feeding. And I wondered what their habits are this time of year, and also where they spend the night and things like that.
Okay. Yeah, their habits are to hang out in your backyard and my backyard and everyone's backyard. And they're really just everywhere now. I had a dozen under my bird feeder the other day, Saturday or Sunday. You know, they're extremely common now. Since 1993, when they were reintroduced to Cape Cod by state wildlife officials, birds from New York and Western Mass were kind of released here on the Cape. And in the last 10 or 15 years, they've really taken off, and they're just everywhere. And so they're happy now with all the acorns. There's acorns all over the ground. That's good food for them. There's still a lot of insects for them. I mean, they're eating a lot, you know, just moving through open grassy areas. They really like to eat lots of grasshoppers and things like that. And at night, they roost in trees. And if you ever get a chance to see turkeys going up to roost, it's comical. It's like this 22-pound bird that they don't like flying. They don't do a lot of flying unless they have to. Just lifting its bulk up into the top of some, you know, pine tree. In my office at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, they roost in the pine trees right outside my office window. So when I'm working there in the evening, you hear this ruckus, I mean, just a racket, and the sound of a dozen 20-pound birds lifting themselves up in the trees, and it's not graceful. You know, they're just, you're like, how does the tree even support them?
Right. they can be kind of nasty too, though.
Yeah, I've never experienced that personally, but I've certainly read the articles of them chasing mailmen.
I say the mail carriers, those poor people, it seems like they zero in on them for some reason.
I know, and then they get mercilessly mocked when they get back to the office. Oh, the turkey's attacking you again there, John. Yeah. I mean, they're big, intimidating birds. And if you ever seen the males fighting, they have these big spurs on their, you know, the back of their leg, and they try to kill each other with those spurs. It's kung fu fighting, really, turkey style. They're like jump kicking each other. It's loud. So they males can be aggressive, and they'll do strange things like attack mailmen, attack cars, bloody themselves against windows. Ours seem to be pretty tame. They don't bother anybody. They're there all summer. Ours at the sanctuary in Wellfleet, you know, they're sort of comic relief for the day camp kids who just watch them. They jog. Ours like to jog, our turkeys. I see them several times a day kind of jogging past my office window on their way to the bird feeders and then back out into the field. They're just sort of funny, funny birds to have around.
All right, Peter, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about migration routes for a second. There's some interesting, we have these geolocators now, and this is Joe Smith who's been doing this work. Tell us a little bit about this so we can actually know where these little birds are, where they're stopping and where they're going.
Yeah. So there's a lot of new technology or relatively new technology being used by ornithologists to study bird migration. Everything from satellite transmitters that give you real-time data on some bigger birds to, for some of the smaller birds where you can't put a like satellite backpack on them because it weighs more than they do, there are these interesting smaller technologies. And one of those is something called a geolocator. It's been used for some smaller shorebirds, things like red knots, and increasingly on songbirds. and you know, purple martins and all kinds of things. The drawback of them is that you need to catch the bird again a year later or whenever, and then download the data. You don't get it's not like satellite uploaded real-time data. And so the geolocator stores information on day length. It records sunlight and uses algorithms to determine where the bird is on the planet at any given time based on day length. Mm-hmm. And it's not perfect, but it gives you a general idea of where the bird is. And so they've been putting it on some of these long-distance migrant birds, particularly black pole warblers and Connecticut warblers, that we suspected were migrating out over the ocean from no further south than New England, the Canadian Maritimes, just launching out over the ocean and flying either nonstop to South America. I mean, this is a, you know,
a little teeny
this
bird.
Is a four inch little bird that weighs nothing. But we could infer that they were long distance migrants just by their physiology. They double their weight in the fall. Can you imagine doubling your weight?
No.
in a few weeks. Yeah. But that's the physiological adaptation that allows this tiny little nothing bird to fly nonstop for 3 days over the Atlantic Ocean during hurricane season to make it to either South America, or the geolocator data indicates that they're stopping in the Caribbean, places like Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Cuba. So that's still a pretty good nonstop flight from here to Haiti, nonstop. And it's just amazing. I thought that they were going straight to South America. I didn't think there were that many records from the Caribbean for black pole warblers. But either way, it's an incredible migration. And so then from Haiti or the Dominican Republic, then they'll hop down to Venezuela, you know, just a quick little jaunt down to Venezuela. And then, into the winter, either there or Colombia, maybe Brazil.
Come back.
Same thing with Connecticut warblers. Connecticut warblers are more obscure species. We see lots of black pole warblers come through here in September and October. Our bird banding station, we get tons of them, and it's fun to talk about this amazing migration with school kids and other visitors to the banding station and show them how fat these birds get. They just turn into these little butterballs. Again, talk about the physiology of migration. But Connecticut warblers, not as common. But they will come through here as well in small numbers, and they do the same thing. They launch out over the ocean, and they'll fly to Haiti, which is not good. Haiti is really heavily deforested, and it doesn't seem like that's changing. There aren't the environmental protections there because it's so poor there, and people are just trying to survive in Haiti. And so there are a number of birds that use Haiti either for breeding or for stopover that are imperiled as a result. And Connecticut warbler is one of them. But their ultimate destination is the interior of the Amazon. I mean, Connecticut warblers are going from spruce bogs in northern Minnesota and Canada to the East Coast, to Haiti, to Amazonia.
That's
in the
crazy
heart of South America.
Yeah.
They just disappear into those jungles. We have several migrants that do that. Purple martins do that. Our little chimney swifts, like nest in the chimney of this building right next to the studio
things,
here. We would watch them sometimes. A little nothing bird. They're gone now. They're gone by mid-September, really. And they're probably in the Amazon by now. Yeah. Just disappear into those jungles for the winter.
And we'll have a link to Joe's article, The Ocean Flyway, The Surprising Open Water Routes of Songbird Migrations. It's an interesting read, so we'll have a link to that up on our website in a little bit. Let's talk to Joan, who's calling us from East Ham. Hi, Joan.
East Harwich.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My
East
neighbor.
Harwich. Hi, Joan.
She's up there. I can walk to her house, I think, from my house.
Good morning.
Hey, Joan.
I have three things. On the 27th and the 28th, I had a rose-breasted grosbeak female in on my feeders.
Very nice.
Nice, pretty.
And then on the and my hummingbird came back on the 1st of October. They were all gone by the 23rd of September.
Me too.
And I don't know if Jose brought her back or what.
Huh.
But on the 2nd of October, I was out back in around 4 o'clock filling my feeders, and I found a crow on the ground sitting there hunkered down, just winking and blinking at me. And after I filled my feeders and cleaned the water pans out, I came in and I called Wildcare, and she told me how to capture it. So I went back out to capture it, and it saw me coming. The first time I was within 5 feet of it, and this time I only got to within 15 feet of it, and it suddenly stood up and flew off.
Oh, boy.
So I called Jennifer back at WildCare and told her that it was playing possum.
Oh, those sneaky crows.
In the morning and look for it to see if it is back on the ground, and it wasn't.
Oh. But just needed a break.
That's what's been going on here.
Can't trust those crows, I tell you. That's a weird one. I'm not sure what was up. It was just having a mild cardiac event or something. Who knows? But the
it looks stunned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it hit something. I mean, this is birds that hit windows often don't die. A lot of birds die from hitting windows, but some are stunned for, you know, maybe an hour or less, and they eventually recover and shake it off and fly away. And I mean, maybe it had a tussle with a hawk or hit something or whatever. Crows are usually pretty savvy. You don't see road-killed crows very often. Mm-hmm. They're pretty street smart, but certainly things like that can happen to them as well. The rose-breasted grosbeak is very nice, and there was a period of about a week where they were obviously migrating through the Cape, because I got several reports of rose-breasted grosbeaks at people's feeders. Mm-hmm. It's not normally a bird we see very often here on the Cape. These weren't the beautiful, if you know what a rose-breasted grosbeak mm-hmm. looks like. The males, an adult male in the breeding season, is just gorgeous.
Beautiful, yeah.
Black head, this crimson triangle on the breast, mm-hmm. Black and white plumage, big seed-cracking bill. But these are the females that are a little more muted looking. You know, they just look like a kind of a big sparrow with a big head and a big bill. But they definitely came through. Our bird bander, James Junda, is also, in addition to running our banding station at Wellfleet Bay, he's also banding on South Monomoy right now, down by the lighthouse, which has a long history of bird banding and ornithological research. We're excited about that, and he had like three that same week come through there. So very obvious migrants just kind of coming through, turning up at people's feeders, which was kind of cool.
And then the hummingbird, gone and then back again? You think it's the same one?
No, I don't think it was brought back. I think increasingly there are late migrants that are coming through. I've had an October ruby-throated hummingbird 2 years in a row. I had one on October 6th last year. And I put out my pineapple sage plants. I get them at the local nursery. Those beautiful red tubular flowers, a great hummingbird plant. I put those out there as kind of a hummingbird trap for late migrants coming through. And I had one, like Joan, I had one on October 1st this year. I haven't had one since. There's a woman in Barnstable Village who's had one every day through at least yesterday. There still seems to be a lingering ruby-throated hummingbird. Yesterday was the 9th. She still had it. That can happen. But we're getting into the period where if you have a hummingbird show up all of a sudden, there's increasing chance that it's something rare. And, you know, give me a call.
Get a photo.
Sue Finnegan, the bird bander at the Museum of Natural History in Brewster, is licensed to band hummingbirds, and she can figure out what kind it is, and she's very good at what she does. So if you see something, especially if it has orange, if you see flashes of orange, you know, you get used to seeing the ruby-throateds, which are kind of plain. The females are green on top, whitish underneath. But if you see any kind of orange color, it's going to be one of the rare hummingbirds.
Ooh.
So give me a call, get the word out, and we'll figure out what it is, because there's a few possibilities.
All right, Joan, thanks for the call. Skip is calling from Woods Hole. Hi, Skip.
Hello. So my hummingbirds disappeared for the first 2 days of May, and then on Friday there was one on the jewelweed in the lee of the house, and then as soon as it went away, they were back until the end of September. But the one that really surprised me was I had a male towhee come into my yard, and I've never seen one in the yard before.
Maybe a migrant. They're actually pretty common. I mean, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, maybe they're not everywhere. But in certain places, my neighborhood, I get them in my yard because there's a lot of oak forest with shrubby oaks, and which is what they like. And so I get them, they breed in my neighborhood, and they're still around. There are migrants coming through, and some of our local birds are still around. A small handful of towhees will spend the winter here. You can find them. You go out on a Christmas count and pish around in the thickets, and you'll turn up a towhee here and there. Most of them leave and head south to like the southern tier states in the U.S. or maybe Mexico. But yeah, always a nice, especially a male. It's a gorgeous bird, and if you're not used to seeing them in your neighborhood, it's a real treat.
Yeah. Skip, thanks for sharing. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, of course, you know, we have our bird feeders to kind of keep our eye on. But you say the month of October, the community gardens is a birding hotspot.
Yeah, yeah. Most towns have these community garden plots, and they're famous among birders for being great, especially in October, for some of the nice, more uncommon October migrants. Like, you might turn up a blue grosbeak, which is a bird that's from further south that we'll get small numbers of here in migration. And when they do turn up, it's usually in some weedy community gardens. And so the key is weedy, right? And so you don't want someone who cuts down all the plants as soon as they go past, and then there's no food for birds in the fall. All those seed heads are gone. But you want messy kind of community garden with foxtail grass growing and ragweed around the edges, and, you know, sunflowers gone to seed, and just messy, weedy community garden. And, you know, they're open to the sun, so there's still insects. Mm-hmm. They're just great spots for migrating sparrows and buntings, indigo buntings you can see there. Don't get your hopes up in the fall. They're pretty much brown. Mm-hmm. In the spring, they're just that intense electric blue. But you have to know what they look like in the fall to pick out indigo buntings now. But any kind of weedy, not even just a community garden, but a weedy gravel pit kind of area, stump dumps where store brush.
And is
brush.
It because they can see as they're, I mean, as you're saying, they're open, they still get a lot of sun, so as they're flying by, are they looking down going, ooh, that looks like a lunch spot right there?
Oh, they're evaluating, that's all they're evaluating the habitat as they fly around, and if there's food, they're there, you know, food and cover. It's pretty simple. There's places to hide and things to eat. They will be there, and community gardens provide all of that. And Dick Sissel is another cool bird that is sort of off of most people's radar.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, Dick Sissel, I had one the other day at Morris Island in Chatham. It flew in. They have this funny call note it's sort of flatulent. this little, that's what their call note is. And this one was calling loudly, and they look like a house sparrow, like a female house sparrow, but with yellow, a little bit of yellow on the breast, a little bit of black, a different face pattern.
Huh.
They're better, you know, I think they're better looking than a house sparrow. But they'll come through in very small numbers, and community gardens, good place to see them, weedy areas. Sometimes they'll turn up in flocks of house sparrows. They're totally unrelated. There's no genetic relationship between house sparrows and Dick Sissels. House sparrows are from Eurasia. They didn't evolve, you know, but somehow Dick Sissel seem to know that they look like house sparrows, and they'll end up hiding among a house sparrow flock.
Wow,
it's kind of funny.
So if you leave you're talking about leaving the plants kind of, as you say, this messy garden. And I have a tendency, just partly because I like the birds to have something in the winter, but also because I just don't have time to get out there and do that.
Yes.
But that's a benefit to those of us who don't have time to go out there and clean up the garden is we may be able to have a winter of visitors, right?
Yeah, right. The anal retentive gardener doesn't provide habitat for much, you know? Just skip it. Just leave especially things in the daisy family, all those asters and goldenrods that are going past, that were
great,
so beautiful throughout September, they're going past now. Your coneflowers, the goldfinches will be all over it. Your liatris, the goldfinches will eat. All those seeds are food for birds. Leave the leaf litter. You know, I can't leave them on your lawn, I guess, but certainly around the edges, don't be too neat with cleaning up your leaf litter. I mean, that's habitat for all kinds of beneficial insects.
Right.
Getting rid of that leaf litter makes things too sterile for the bees and other things that would like to overwinter under there, other insects.
Yeah. You're going to have to rake up in the spring anyway. Even if you clean up in the fall, there's still going to be stuff. There's leaves and things that blow around. So why not wait till the spring?
Yeah, or don't have a lawn at all. Those really like electric green lawns with really crisp edges. Oh, they give me the heebie-jeebies. It's like, just think of all the fertilizer and everything. There's just no need for it.
All right, let's talk to Marilyn, who's calling us from Truro. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi there. first of all, we did have a grosbeak that hung around for, oh gosh, I guess 4 or 5 days out here in my feeder here in Truro.
Nice.
So I think they were an equal opportunity bird for a few days.
Yeah.
But my main question is about my catbirds. I have always had 2 catbirds that would hang around. They'd come about the same time as the Baltimores. And they would eat my jelly. They would eat the oranges, of course. But we also have a bug catcher, and we put a tray of bugs out every morning. And by late afternoon, all the bugs would have been eaten by the catbirds.
Hmm.
They seem very social.
They seem to have. I think I love the catbirds too. They're like they have a personality. I don't know how to. Yeah.
Catbirds are great, and we're lucky to have a lot of them here in the Cape. I had one in my yard this morning. They're sort of. You know, our local ones may have left and others that are migrating through. A lot of them migrate through the Cape here this time of year because we have so much food for them. Maryland seems to be providing most of it, but there's also a lot of natural food out there in the form of fruit. But they're not social compared to other things like robins. You know, they don't flock. I mean, they're, you know, they're social when they're in their family groups, but then they're pretty solitary.
Yeah.
You'll see catbirds that will...
around the yard.
Oh, yeah,
social with people. Yeah.
People, yeah. Well, and what
it's
a great
feeding them.
What a great idea with the bug tray.
I would follow you around your yard if you were feeding me every day too. So just so you know, the bug tray. Yeah, that's a cool idea.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. What is your bug catcher?
It's one that you can't find anymore. It has a tray of water in it and a light and a fan, and you turn it on at night, and it's got a blue light in it, and it attracts all the bugs. And they can't get out because they fall down into the water. So I just pull the tray out, stick it up on the railing, and they get totally clean, washed bugs.
Oh my goodness, that is a brilliant idea.
Interesting. Well, what does it kill? Like, if it's getting mosquitoes, okay, but it's probably killing lots of nice moths and things that we, you know, probably don't want to kill. What kind of stuff are you getting in there?
I'm getting a lot of mosquitoes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Moths. Occasionally June bugs.
Yeah.
There's
plenty of June bugs in the world.
The same all the time. It's not like I'm wiping out a species. Or
yeah.
There are a few there, but they love them.
Right. Yeah, at least it's going to the birds. Yeah.
All right.
Good.
Well, Marilyn, thanks for the call. Thanks for that. That's a great idea with a bug tray. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Hang on, Mike. We'll talk to you right after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your comments, questions, or bird stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And I should say, not just bird stories, any kind of natural world critters we'll talk about. Mike,
yes.
Mike is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering now. I live on the Munichus River in Waukoi, and now the ospreys are gone. I'm just wondering when the mergansers come back and where they migrate from.
Yeah, so waterfowl migration, the sea ducks are moving right now. I haven't seen mergansers. I haven't been checking too many ponds, but the end of the month, I would say, you know, maybe someday where it's not 80 degrees. We get an actual cold front coming through. We'll start to get some of these mergansers coming in. So red-breasted mergansers will come to the saltwater from further north. Hooded mergansers will show up on ponds by the end of the month into November, through November. And common mergansers are not very common on the Cape. They like big reservoirs and things like that, but they're handful of places where they might turn up, like Lake Wequawket, in Hyannis, and some of the bigger places, maybe Mashpee, Wakeby. Mm. But so those are your three mergansers. The bulk of their nesting territory is further north of us, like across Canada. They like to nest along rivers where they nest in cavities in trees and dead trees, kind of like wood ducks do. All the mergansers are cavity nesters. But they're on their way. They're not here yet. But certainly by November, they'll be showing up. And then later in November, the golden eyes will start showing up. Also, cavity nesting ducks from further north that will come through here. Common golden eyes will start turning up on both salt and fresh water. So They're out there. They're on their way.
On their way.
But yeah, they'll right. be here.
Mike, thanks for the call. Let's talk a little about the Wimbrow satellite tracking. What's happening there?
Yeah, so this is a fun project that I've been sort of piggybacking on. It's a project of Brad Wynn at Manomet Inc., formerly the Manomet Bird Observatory, something he's been doing since he was working with Georgia DNR down there in Georgia. But it's part of a larger project looking at Wimbrels, which is Wimbrel are a big sandpiper. We have a lot of them in Wellfleet and around Wellfleet Bay, Wellfleet Harbor, because we have a lot of healthy salt marsh and a lot of fiddler crabs. And fiddler crabs is, you know, it's one of their favorite things to eat. They just gobble these things down. And we really do have bazillions and bazillions of fiddler crabs in around Wellfleet Harbor and at the sanctuary. And so they nest in the Arctic. One of the main nesting areas is the Mackenzie River Delta in northern Canada. I didn't realize this, but the Mackenzie River is the second largest river in North America after the Mississippi. It's this obscure river in western Canada that flows north out into the Arctic Sea. And so that delta is one of the big breeding populations. So from there, the Wimbrels head, a lot of them will head east across Canada to the Canadian Maritimes and some down here where you can see them in places like Wellfleet or Chatham. And then they go to maybe South America, the Caribbean. So we're not sure what different populations do, and especially not sure what the young birds do. Young birds are always kind of a missing piece in our knowledge of some of these species and where they go and what they do during the winter. And so Brad's been putting satellite transmitters on juvenile Wimbrels to try to figure out where they go. Nobody has ever done this for Wimbrels in the Northeast. And so 2 years ago, he put one on a Wimbrel caught in Chatham, and that bird would roost at night on the north end of South Monomoy, which is kind of what people always suspected Wimbrels did at night. We always knew that they flew somewhere in the evening towards Chatham and probably roosted on Monomoy. That bird did. That bird migrated to the Virgin Islands. Can't remember which one, but it spent that whole winter and then the whole next year down there before finally migrating north this past spring to Louisiana and then to coastal Texas, right on the Mexico border there, the Gulf Coast of Texas, and then sort of disappeared. Either it died or shed the transmitter or something. So we didn't quite get the full story on where that bird which breeding population that bird was heading towards. Just back in September, we were out there again at the Lieutenant Island Bridge there in Wellfleet, some salt marsh owned by Mass Audubon, owned by the sanctuary, and put out these little noose lines. It's basically a line with a bunch of monofilament nooses on it, and you put it somewhere based on your scouting where you've seen them hanging out, some creek bank or something where they hang out on high tide. And Brad's really good at this, and you just kind of, they get their toe caught in it, and then you go grab them and put the transmitter on them and let them go. And so we caught one, and we named it Sachem. Brad was really intent on giving it a Native American name, and so Sachem has done very well. We learned last couple years that Wellfleet seems to have its own nighttime roost for Wimbrels over on Jeremy Point. In Billingsgate, if you're familiar with that area of Great Island, kind of a remote part of Wellfleet out in the outer part of the harbor. So that was kind of interesting. That was something we did not know. And then one day, Sachem up and migrated and is now all of a sudden in Venezuela. A bird we were seeing around the sanctuary in Wellfleet every day just found some favorable winds and flew out over the open Atlantic. About where Bermuda is, like that far out. And that was at the time that Hurricane Maria was out there. So Sachem flew east of Maria, sort of went around that hurricane. Sometimes Wimbrels will fly straight through a hurricane.
Wow.
They can't avoid it. And they'll buck the headwinds flying into the north end of a hurricane, you know, just struggling along at 9 miles an hour or something like that. Then through the eye and then get spit out the other side where they could be flying 90 miles an hour.
My goodness.
With the ridiculous tailwinds that you get from a hurricane.
Yeah.
So they're tough birds, are really strong flyers. And so Sachem did not stop in the Caribbean like the previous bird, the bird from Chatham a couple of years ago, but went all the way to northern, the north end of Venezuela, north end of South America.
You know, I think they're very pretty birds. And you think of like of the colorful birds people like, but there's something about the pattern that's just very attractive.
Oh, you're becoming a birder. You can appreciate the brown birds,
the
sparrows.
It's like, it's a very pretty brown bird.
Birds only a birder can love. They're gorgeous. Yeah, I mean, and there's so much about whimbrels that are fascinating. The long migration, that crazy bill. They have that long sickle bill that they've shown seems to match the angle of fiddler crab burrows around here. And there's so many fiddler crabs in Wellfleet that they just walk. They're just wading among the fiddler crabs, just picking them off at will. But when they're a little more scarce, they can go down into the burrows and pick them out with that ridiculous bill.
Yeah.
They're just really cool birds. And so we're really pulling for Sachem, hoping that Sachem lives. And like ospreys, these young ones, he won't migrate back north next spring
with
the adults. Yeah. It'll stay down there somewhere in South America if it survives for another full year and will migrate the spring after next. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the transmitter is still alive, the bird is still alive, and this bird shows us what breeding population these young birds that come through the Cape here in the fall are coming from.
Yeah. Dan writes, the last couple of early mornings as I've ridden my bicycle down the path into Woods Hole, when I ring my bike bell, a bird or two seems to respond. I'm not sure what bird it is. Could my bike bell be mistaken for another bird? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, birds are responsive to sounds. You know, that's the whole basis of technique all birders know, which is pishing, right? You walk up to some thicket you suspect has birds in it, but it's quiet and you don't see anything, and you do this kind of you make this sound that sounds like a scolding, like it sounds like an angry chickadee. You're sort of imitating an angry chickadee or titmouse, kind of gets birds' curiosity up. But any kind of, I make squeaking sounds, and sometimes you clap to get birds to respond, like marsh birds. You just sort of clap and they'll be startled and they'll talk back at you. I wouldn't be surprised if he was hearing spring peepers. The frogs, the little frogs known as spring peepers.
He's saying no.
Dan saying no.
No. But you know what? Maybe it's that they're birds and they're going, look out, here comes Dan. Get out of the way.
Yeah. So you know spring peepers and it's not spring peepers. Okay. That was just a theory because spring peepers become very vocal again in the fall. And so I've been hearing them every night. It's not like in the spring where these deafening choruses of spring peepers, but you'll get individuals here and there who kind of pipe up. And I find that they are also like you can slam your car door and a peeper will peep a few times. That's the only reason I mention that. But so, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I think Dan is pioneering a new birding technique here. It was all of a sudden, all
his
the birders would
bell.
Be carrying bike bells.
All right, so we've got less than a minute left. You want to real quick, you were doing the red knot trapping project, but no luck, right? We've talked about this before.
Yeah, so I help out with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife red knot research that they've been doing for many years. It's kind of like the whimbrel research, trying to see where the juveniles go, among other questions. Red knots are struggling because of the impacts of climate change on their high Arctic nesting grounds, as well as over-harvest of horseshoe crabs in Delaware Bay, which they depend on their eggs to fuel up and breed successfully when they pass through Delaware Bay in the spring on their way back to the Arctic. So a couple of different things working against red knots. So this is an important project. This year we got skunked. Jose shut down the first trapping window. It's incredibly logistically challenging. Oh, we really are out of time.
Yeah.
But anyway,
right.
next time, we'll catch up on it.
We'll keep trying. Yeah. All right, Mark Faraday here the second Tuesday of the month, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thanks, Mark.
All right, see you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.